to Real Geeks. I am Crash and Burn, and with me as always is Mike Montgomery.
Hey.
And today I've got a burning passion, a red hot fever, a problem in my pants with heat. I should see a doctor. And my ears out of flame. Yes, it is a triple whammy. I'm gonna say triple whammy, because technically there are three here, of Firestarters. Stephen King's original 1980 novel, the 1984 classic film, and 2022's starring Zac Efron and that guy from that 70s show. It's a really weird one.
I'm just gonna say, when you said three, I thought you had somehow squeezed in the miniseries from the early 2000s as well.
No, but only due to lack of time. I kind of fell down the wiki rabbit hole of that one, being like, oh yeah, I remember that. Which then led me down the wiki rabbit hole of that Dead Zone TV show. You remember that one?
Oh, yeah.
Which led me down to, anyway, we're not going to go into that. So, to start off with, Mike, have you ever read Firestarter?
No.
Well, that answers that. have you ever read, like, much Stephen King?
Actually, again, no.
Oh, okay, good. So I've read tons of Stephen King. In high school, over the course of about a year and a half, I read 60 plus of his novels, like his classics, all the way from his original Carrie, right up to, there's one that takes place, it's a girl who's lost in the woods and she's obsessed with baseball. It was not nearly as memorable as, say, The Stand, or The Shining, or Salem's Lot, or Firestarter, which is just fantastic. And Firestarter is one of his odd books, where it's not, like, necessarily a horror, and it's definitely not in his usual vein of people living in and around Maine having to deal with supernatural, like, spooky hauntings, and essentially being cut off from the world. Like, they're isolated, everything's going horrible, there's usually a lot of bigotry involved. Firestarter is a little different, because it's less that there's isolation and more like you're being hunted by the government. This isn't the Crimson King coming after you. There's which, like, he's the high Satan behind, like, pretty much every terrible thing that has happened in every Stephen King book. This is, like, this book happens aside. This has nothing to do with that entirely. It's just this really fun romp through Stephen King's understanding of MK Ultra. And it came out, like, just after all of that was declassified that's true. Yeah, we did all that. Ooh, sorry.
Yeah.
And of course, tons of culture came out of that at the time. But this is Stephen King's, and it is a superb kind of, I don't want to call it supernatural thriller. It's a telekinetic thriller, a mutant thriller, and we'll get more into that in a bit. But for the most part, the plot doesn't change between these three aspects. There is a child. The child is named Charlie. Child is raised by two parents who have, like, mild to decent psychic powers, who were subject to a MK Ultra experiment taking a drug called Lot 6. And this like bubbles up a couple of different reactions in some people. Namely, 8 out of the 10 original subjects violently kill themselves or die.
Yeah.
And one guy rips out his own eyes because he's, like, seen horrible things in that Crimson King universe. But again, that's the only connection that we have to the Dark Tower. I am talking words that you have, like, barely any reference to. But anyway, these two happening hip cats go and have a kid, and that kid is, like, bizarrely powerful psychically, specifically pyrokinetically. So this is, like, it's kind of like the same vein as Akira, where if you have a bunch of psychics, have sex with psychics and then raise those psychics, you end up with a weapon. And that weapon is named Charlie.
Exactly. And Akira is probably an even more accurate comparison in that simply, I wouldn't call Charlie pyrokinetic so much as plot kinetic.
Yes. She is whatever is necessary.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Technically, the secret bastards who are after them, the shop, label
the shop.
The shop. Are you in for the shop?
Steven, buddy, we know what the CIA looks like, okay?
The shop.
Sure.
they label her a pyrokinetic, whereas her father is a telekinetic and her mother is a tactile kinetic. She could move stuff with her mind. Her father can get in your head and control you, and she can make stuff go boom.
Yeah, the mom would be telekinetic. The father,
telepathic. Yeah. Telepathic. That's it. Yeah, yeah. And so, the mother's the weakest of them. She just didn't have as much power. The father has power, but it slowly kills him. And Charlie's just a bundle of fun. anyway, the book begins with Charlie and her father already on the run, having been hunted down by the shop. And from there, and we'll get into it because it just works as an easy transition.
Yeah.
It pretty much happens as the 1984 movie does. The 1984 movie is one of those films that is like, you just took the script that Stephen King had, on the page and you went with it. And that's good and bad when it comes to pacing.
Charlie McGee is a healthy 8-year-old girl, normal in every way.
Charlie, now watch what you're doing.
But one.
Did she do that?
What are you gonna do with her?
I'll bring her here, so you can do all your tests, and you give her to me.
Charlie has the power.
Do something bad? Will you still love me?
Oh, Charlie.
She can set things on fire.
Something's happening in there.
With just a glance. It is a power she does not want.
Stick with him.
Daddy, I'm scared.
So am I, honey.
A power she cannot control.
Back up.
The 84 one, for me, it starts off great. It's exciting. There's that moment where they refer to, and by the way, I think this study was in college, not high school.
Oh, yeah, I meant to say.
Small thing there, but I love how they specifically refer to it as a double-blind study and specifically say that they don't know who's getting Lot 6 and who's getting Stillwater.
Yeah.
Remember, folks, it was the early 80s. Saline solution was not a term yet. and maybe a scene and a half later, front and center, right in the middle of the camera, is a bottle clearly labeled Lot 6 that they're drawing from to inject into someone.
Oh, yeah. And to give to just everyone. This is no double blind. Y'all getting fucked up. And while
there's no blind.
Yeah, and while our two parents get to have this wonderful, mental communication level, astral plane harmony thing, everyone else is killing themselves and going apeshit. And it's a fun scene. So directed by Mark L. Lester, with screenplay by Stanley Mann based on Stephen King's. Couple of things that stand out in this film immediately, which are just hilarious. First, this is a fantastic example of a Dino De Laurentiis movie where it's just ham and cheese taken as seriously as possible. It's a lovely platter, a smorgasbord of B movie. Wonderful. Second is that the other producer on this is Frank Capra. Fucking what?
That's a, Yeah, I was going to say, that was an interesting pairing.
I mean, you're watching them come out. It's like, oh, Dino, okay, all right. Now I'm in the right headspace. Frank fucking Capra.
Wait, what?
How did Frank fucking Capra get involved in this goddamn production? Wow, actually, no, he was involved. That's fascinating. I would love to know what Frank Capra thought about Firestarter, like the Stephen King book. I'd love to hear his thoughts on Stephen King. Oh, that's so fascinating. Well, yes, I stand corrected. Apparently, he was quite involved. He went location scouting. What? Anyway.
Yeah, for a producer, that is pretty damn involved.
Like, damn. Okay. Anyway, starring David Keith, not Keith David. This would have been an incredible film if it was Keith David. And terrifying Drew Barrymore. Freddie Jones, Heather Locklear, and Martin Sheen. And then the last two, Louise Fletcher as well. But Art Carney. Okay, that's... Why is Art Carney in this film? Okay, that's... All right, whatever. George C. Scott. C. Scott.
There are things that need to be said about that casting.
And like, it's a hell of a performance. It's a hell of a performance.
Oh, yeah.
But understand, listeners, George C. Scott is playing a Navajo Vietnam vet. George C. Scott is not Navajo.
No.
It's George C. Scott dressed like Steven Seagal. The entire movie. Oh, and when he puts the eye patch on, it's just, why does he have this eye patch suddenly? Did George C. Scott just make a decision?
No, actually, the eye patch, I was just looking through the IMDb trivia while you were talking a minute ago, and... Literally, the answer literally is there. Apparently, he had an eye infection from the contact lenses he was wearing. And it just wasn't healed enough. So for part of the movie, he had to wear the eye patch.
He literally puts it on in a scene. No one comments on it. It goes forward. He eventually takes it off. No one comments on. There is a little girl in the room who could just give her the dialogue. Why do you have an eye patch? And he could come up with a fun story and that goes away. No, it's just for some of this movie, George C. Scott looks like a Navajo pirate.
Yeah, I mean, it's like I've always said, just that one line. Just give us that one line to glue things together. That's all you had to do.
And, like, there's enough dialogue in this film, that's for sure.
Oh, Lord, yeah.
This is a wonderfully talky 2 hours, and then stuff blows up real good. And don't get me wrong, there's a good pace to this film for being an 80s film. It's solid, it's got action scenes that don't feel dated. Like, they used a hell of a lot of pyro gel in this movie. A hell of a lot of pyro gel.
Oh, yeah, no, like, especially for an 84 film, there are points where, like, people's hair is being lit on fire. And I know how they would do that today. Back then, I would like to know how they pulled that off.
Yeah, yeah, and there are multiple scenes where it's just as many stunt dudes as we can find who are willing to be lit on fire. We need as many of you. We've got 6? Cool. You're all... Full blaze. Yeah, incredible. And yeah, like, I would be fascinated to know how they were able to shoot so much fire effects, like, legally, I mean, around Drew Barrymore, who was probably 6. It's like, this feels dangerous.
Yeah, well, that, and also, it was an early 80s Dino De Laurentiis film. Legal might be debatable.
Children? What? No, these are really great actors in incredible makeup. We would never endanger children in a Dino De Laurentiis movie. No,
just get the shot. Just get the shot. We'll deal with the rest of it later.
Jesus Christ, get the fucking shot. Get the fucking shot. and it was a mild success. I mean, like, this is a B movie in the 80s. It did decent at the box office. It didn't set anything on fire.
Except maybe Drew Barrymore's sobriety.
Except maybe Drew Barrymore's sobriety, which, considering how young she was, that's depressing.
Yeah, it's a frightening thought when you can't help but think to yourself that I'm 42 years old, and Drew Barrymore could have drunk me under the table when she was 10.
Yep. And then moved on to drink another one under the table.
Yep.
And she has a surly performance. Like, it works. It's fantastic. I really believe Charlie as a character, because she's just so fucking surly. She's like, this is a surly young child. She has seen shit. She is over it. No, thank you. I'm not dealing with your crap.
But between the two actors, in terms of Charlie just as a child, Drew Barrymore is giving the better performance.
Absolutely. Yeah. It's more nuanced, but also they give her more time. The second film, which we'll go into, I really feel it's Zac Efron's movie. It's not about her. It's about him. Whereas this was solidly it's about Charlie. Drew Barrymore is the star. She's surrounded by incredible actors who never pull focus from her. So, like, that's both a talent of hers, a talent of theirs to not overact or over take up space, and a talent of the director and the production team to be able to make this very tiny child in pigtails incredibly menacing without relying on, like, boring ass tropes about it. She doesn't Kubrick stare. Like,
no,
she doesn't.
Well,
I mean, there's aspects of it, but like, isn't that stare that there would be now, where it's a, there's tropes and presumptions that come through quite a bit in the next one that people expect to see. And at this time, those tropes and presumptions weren't fully laid out yet. Like, I love how her father prepares himself to mind whammy people. Like, he just grabs his head to explode. Like, I love it, because you do later see it in, like, Akira and stuff, where people start doing that, and it's like, I like the intensity it gives it. It really makes you feel like they're going to, like, blow a wall out. But I am happy that we don't have to sit through, like, Patrick Stewart doing that, where he just, like, rips and grips his head and goes,
yeah, for me, every time David Keith, who, side note, apparently in the early 80s had a great Kurt Russell impression.
Oh, yeah, like, there's a guy who...
He is low-budget Kurt Russell in this movie.
Absolutely, and that is not an offense to him. He is fantastic in this film. Yeah. But the whole time you're like, what is he, his brother or something?
Right?
Oh, it's Kurt Russell with makeup on. Aha!
Yes, clearly.
It's Keith David in a Kurt Russell mask.
Yeah. or as we usually call him, David Keith.
David Keith.
I mean, yes, it would have been nice if it was Keith David, but...
Gonna burn you, motherfuckers. The whole movie would start and stop with him just, like, holding her up like a gun. And, like, it's like, you tried to fuck with the wrong person. Burn her, baby. Burn them all. Just 2 straight hours of Keith David burning people alive with a child. Or I believe that was a DLC for Saints Row.
No, actually, there was so much Keith David that was main game content. there's an entire mission in the game, Saints Row 4, if I remember correctly. that is literally, you're just reenacting They Live.
Yeah, yeah. I love it.
Exactly.
But,
oh, me too.
But speaking of, and going back a few minutes, like Professor X and all that, this is, and it really hit me on this rewatch, and I remember having this feeling with the book years and years ago. This is a fantastic proto X-Men film.
Yeah, actually, yeah.
So much to the point that in X2, when Wolverine and the kids are on the run, they reenact the entire farmhouse scene.
Nice.
It's the same shots, the same setup, except in that time, in that version, Pyro has, like, he's got his mutant powers, and Bobby's got his mutant powers, and then, of course, Magneto shows up. Whereas here, it's just Charlie lighting everything on fire and making shit explode. But it is at some points, shot for shot. It is, it hit me the minute. I'm like, oh my god, this is that scene from X2. Why did I completely forget that it just lifts it practically whole hog? And I don't mean, like, copies it. It's a wonderful, like, and I don't want to sing the praises of this director or even say his goddamn name because he's disgusting.
Fair.
But
fair.
It's a wonderful nod to Firestarter being essentially non-canon X-Men. It even reads like Chris Claremont. This is a solid 80s X-Men story. It's a great New Mutant story. That's for fuck sure.
Oh, amen to that.
Yeah, there's so much in this I love.
Yeah, I just love that minor detail of how every time Andrew uses his powers, it's slowly but surely going to kill him.
Yeah.
So now when he grabs his head, it looks terrible.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
But it,
like,
makes sense.
He's the worse he looks, the better the head grammy looks. Because, like, at first you're like, okay, that's kind of silly. But when, like, blood is pouring out of his nose and he's amped himself up to be just, like, beat red in the face and his eyes are, like, bugging out and he's pulled his face back. And it's like, yeah, I honestly believe that, like, if you don't focus this right now, your own head's about to explode. Scanners. Oh, yeah. Full scanners. You never go full scanners.
Well, unless you're actually in scanners.
But Martin Sheen's in this movie. He gives a fantastic performance as, like, not quite as a government officer sleazebag. Like, I'm in charge of some dark shit, but I'm not necessarily, like, an evil guy. I'm just, you know, this is the department I run. And I like how even in the end, like, he's not saved. He's not a good guy by the end, but it's like,
no.
I'll just mind control you. And so you become an ally by function. It's just, that's nice. Martin Sheen gets to be the hero somewhat in the end until he gets shot in the head by George C. Scott.
Yeah, he's not evil, but he is very much a company man.
Mm-hmm. And I like the way they broke the characters down like that. Like, there are a couple of, you'd call them villains, but very few of them are actually villainous, and all of them are responsible, but in different ways. Like, there's the scientist who is guilt-ridden for having created the experiment. Martin Sheen playing the company man, the captain, who's just trying to, you know, make sure that this program runs well, because at the end of that, then I'll get a promotion and, you know, like, another successful program of the American military and et cetera, et cetera. And then there is George C. Scott's, and I want to get his exact name here.
John Rainbird.
Yeah, John Rainbird. Who fought in Vietnam, and he goes around wearing beaded jackets, and I swear to God, has the loudest pedophile energy in film for someone who is not openly playing a pedophile. It's creepy.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. He is just openly obsessed with Charlie.
Oh, and like the things he says, like, oh, okay, you wrote this in the 80s and you took it only one way, and that was entirely innocent, but holy shit, George C. Scott, just shut up. Stop talking about the child, George C. Scott.
Now, I should also note, full disclosure, that this is during the middle section of the movie where I nodded off 3 times while watching it.
Yeah, so as
so
this is...
I missed stuff?
Yeah, okay, so go back and rewatch some of those scenes between him and Charlie. They are extra creepy. I mean, it's like textbook grooming. Just, oh my God. But the reason that this film lulls is because it is such a great reproduction of Stephen King's work. And one problem with Stephen King is he writes, or at least when he was really, really, really in his zone, he was fueled and writes like he is fueled by narcotics. So there's ups and downs and ups and downs and depressions. And there is a depression in this story where they get captured.
Oh, is there ever?
And spend the next 6 months just doing tests and hanging out. And her dad becomes a fat drug addict. And that's it. Like, it just grinds to a halt so that we can build this trust relationship between Charlie and John.
Yeah, that was one of the big things where I was going, wait, what?
Yeah, where it's just, okay, no, this has not been optimized for cinema. This is still operating like it is a book. And it hits the brakes. And what does it hit the brakes for? Grooming. Ew. Ew. And you get about half an hour of just, ew. Ew. But it really, I feel, it really does a lot to build up the inevitable revenge, because you can just see Drew Barrymore becoming more and more kind of over it and frustrated and sick of this shit. And like, she's a terrific performer even at that young age. And it really builds the tension so well. Unlike the new one, which does it in about half hour, like real time, half hour, the entire third act occurs.
Give or take.
Yeah. Whereas like, this is just luxuriating in its destruction. Everything burns. Everything burns. She can Kamehameha like with her mind. She throws flaming meteors at you and you explode. And then you fly off Team Rocket style. Ah, the excess in this film. The excess.
Oh, yeah. No, like that final act, I'm sitting there going, okay, meteors, when?
Boosh, yeah! Boosh, yeah!
Like, one of the faults for me with the 84 movie is how Charlie's power set, like we said earlier, is plot kinetic. It's so there's no consistency with her powers at all.
Yeah.
And her core power is, of course, pyrokinesis. So, you know, like, she can make things light on fire with her mind. That, I'm pretty sure, does not involve creating matter out of thin air and then lighting it on fire and then telekinetically throwing it at things.
Yeah, one of my favorite parts of 80s Stephen King books are when they try to make the things that he writes make sense on screen. It's like watching the original miniseries of It, and you're like, you tried, but like, that man was on so much coke, that wasn't going to make any sense. And so it comes out as fireball. But really, it was like gravitational twisting ethereum of pain and torment being thrown. And it heats up. Yeah, it's like, Ah, hell, what does that look like on screen? I have a $5 yeah. budget.
And then Charlie's just out of nowhere bulletproof.
Ah, yes. That's kind of in the book. She stops one bullet by melting it before it reaches her.
Okay, that I could buy.
Yeah, but I do love watching her just go full fucking Jean Grey. I mean, that last 20 minutes is just... This is the best Dark Phoenix we have ever seen.
Yes, that's a low bar.
It's a low bar, but like...
However...
Hold on, I will actually look one thing up here. Okay, the Dark Phoenix saga was published around the same time as the book. So it's funny book and then the movie 4 years later do it perfectly. Like, here's exactly what you want. Here it is. Here's a little girl with mutant powers just fucking unleashing Inferno. And then they couldn't do it again for another 40 years. They still haven't given us a good one.
Incredible. Well, I was just going to say, they just plain couldn't do it.
Drew Barrymore is the best Phoenix. That's incredible.
Yeah.
I just hadn't considered that. In terms of great, amazing 80s schlock, in terms of, like, psychological government paranoia films, in terms of even just a mutant film, an X-Men film, a comic book film, I love this. This was fantastic.
I think on my end, it'd be more just that I liked it predominantly just because of that middle section, again, just dragged it down so much.
And that's completely fair. I feel like for me, that section works because I've read far too much Stephen King. I understand and like am familiar with it as an environment in which, you know, certain things happen and you're not supposed to be looking for other things. The problem is movie audiences are usually looking for something else at that point. Whereas if you are used to his books, you're like, okay, this is the moment when we slow things down and we'll learn some stuff and we'll have some backstory and some character will like build a fictional reality as a lie that'll collapse and that'll cause the inevitable final confrontation. It's Stephen King's a fantastic writer, but boy, he can be predictable once you figure out what he's doing.
Oh yeah, totally.
Yeah. So I completely understand. Yeah. And it's an entirely valid complaint about that lull. It only works if you're like already a massive fan of this property, I feel.
I was also starting to get a little annoyed with how no matter where Charlie and Andy went, the shop somehow conveniently had agents like already there.
Yeah, wasn't that fun? I mean, it makes sense now with modern technology, but back then... And actually, that's a great way of transitioning into the next one, because one major theme that I believe makes old Stephen King work and makes new Stephen King, or at least modernized adaptations of Stephen King, not work, is isolation is necessary. You need to feel alone. And with modern technology, the internet, cell phones, texting, all that shit, social media, it's so difficult. It's hard to do that. You can have the information you need in the palm of your hand immediately instead of having to like find the book in the back of a haunted library in a town that wants to kill you. You know, the answers and the solution to loneliness is right there. And that robs so much of Stephen King's work, which is driven by isolation and depression and all of that stuff.
And even when they try to address it, it still doesn't work.
Yeah.
Because you can't help but go, okay, wait a minute. There's a scene early on in the school where we find out Charlie doesn't have internet.
Oh, yes. Yeah, actually, that's the thing, is I think the movie even kind of agrees with me on this. But I feel like the government agents in the first movie, knowing where they are always, is a great paranoia driver. It doesn't have to make sense.
Yeah, that's true.
When you are afraid and you have no idea, like, they are isolated, but it's society trying to get them instead of, like, being isolated from society. But society is malevolent in this case, and it is connected, is working with each other. It is talking to each other, and you can't even, you have no idea who's giving you up. You have no idea who's actually a spy. And that's something that comes up in the movies a few times, is like they get given up by people who they think they can trust. They get given up by spies who innocuously appear to be people they can trust, or just bystanders. The omnipresent, unavoidable scrutiny of the system in that is very important, and it plays so well. And so, yeah, they in the new one, it's to avoid being easily found by the NSA, they stay off the internet. They don't have cell phones and all that. And it works in a great way of, like, addressing that and being like, well, they are cut off because, yes, you're right. If they could just, like, Google other, you know, like, if they could email a journalist, this might get exposed. If they just, like, posted video of her being pyrokinetic, they could easily get on at least late night television, if not, like, you know, expose this whole thing. They could go in the dark web and probably find other subjects or people who could do this. Isolation necessary. The explanation for it as we can't be tracked, that worked. Okay, cool. I like it. You've effectively erased the last 20 to 30 years of technological evolution, which was necessary to keep the plot as it is. Otherwise, the whole thing goes out the fucking window. Cool. I like that.
Yeah.
Good. I like that this one is thinking sometimes.
Yeah, like, there are instances like that where it's like, that doesn't work, but I see that you are at least trying.
Daddy.
What's going on, sweetie?
Something feels weird. Something's changing.
You remember the tools we taught you, right?
Pencil, desk, paper, shoes.
You're weird. Everything okay, Charlie?
It happened again.
What happened?
The bad thing.
If you ever start to lose control, what do you do?
It didn't work. She's not a robot, Annie. She's a little girl. With little girl emotions, which are wildly unpredictable. Charlie?
She just has to shove it down and keep it hidden.
Our responsibility is getting her ready.
Our responsibility is to protect her.
Charlie?
If they catch her, they're gonna put her in a cage.
Charlie?
They're gonna run tests on her for the rest of her life. We'll never see her again.
If who catches me?
Produced by Blumhouse, and, you know, they do a damn good job. It just never quite turns into horror like their old stuff used to, and A24 now absolutely does. Directed by Keith Thomas, based on Scott, a screenplay by Scott Teams. This one now stars Zac Efron, Ryan Kira Armstrong, Sidney Lemon, Kirkwood Smith, a couple of other people. But once again, a funny name appears in the credits in a spot that you didn't expect. Score by John Carpenter.
John Carpenter and his son.
Fuck yeah. Like, it actually made me go back and be like, wait a minute. Did John Carpenter, like, direct the original Firestarter? Because that would be a great... It's like, I won't come back to direct movies. I fucking hate movies now. But I will do the score, because I have had thoughts since that first one about what I was going to do. It's just, oh, shit. I should... We should have gone high synth there, not low synth.
Oh, no. If John Carpenter had directed the 84 movie, the 84 movie would have had a much better score.
It really would. It has an 80s-tastic score, but nothing stands out. This one, despite having a slight made-for-streaming feel, has an incredible score. And no shit, it's Carpenter and Son. Yeah, it's gonna be amazing.
Yeah, exactly. And well, that even that made for streaming feel almost works in its favor solely in that with the opening of the 84 movie, it was giving me a made for TV vibe.
I can understand that. Yeah, no.
Yeah.
Especially like, great 80s television. Like you could see it go to a commercial of like the Incredible Hulk and then, you know, Ferrero Rocher. So fancy.
Yeah, and then we get the first act of this new movie where a lot of it felt like, and I say this fully aware that production schedules would make this impossible. It felt like somebody went, okay, we're going to take Dr. Sleep, we're going to take Turning Red, we're going to put them together and hope nobody notices.
Yeah, and maybe that's just aspects of King. Like, Turning Red and Carrie deal with girls going through puberty in very different ways, but you're going to see that come up a lot in Stephen King. Puberty, the terrifying changes that come with it, et cetera, et cetera. So these are themes. All of these are themes that are just like, they're Stephen King themes. But because he rinses and repeats them so much, sometimes you can see other stories in it. Or in this case, whereas the book and the previous movie begin in Midia's res, and all of this has already occurred and we get some flashbacks, I feel like to stand out and to streamline the story a little bit, they decide to actually start a little bit further back. And to make it fit narratively and stylistically, they chose to crib aspects and elements of how it would be done from other King material.
Oh, no doubt. Yeah, it's like, it wasn't necessarily a bad thing, but it does really jump out.
It does, but I really like how, and I said before, I feel like this is Zac Efron's movie, not,
yeah,
like Firestarter 1984 was Drew Barrymore's movie. This Firestarter 2022 is Zac Efron's movie, and we need these scenes to help relate to him. Like, we need to see that everyman hero trying to have that normal life, like to see what gets taken away from him. You can't have empathy for Job until Job fucking suffers, you know, and that's the basis for every action father in Hollywood for like 40 years at this point. Yeah,
pretty much. And I mean, also there's the simple fact that this should be Ryan Kira Armstrong's movie because she's, of course, Charlie.
Yes.
But Zac Efron is the name actor.
Yeah. And it's not that she doesn't give a fantastic performance. She does. She's great. She's to say that she's not as good as Drew Barrymore is unfair to her because Drew Barrymore is the third generation of an acting legend family. She's been around Hollywood and actors and acting coaches and drama since she was literally like a little child. She was a main actor in E.T. when she was, that was 82, right?
I think so, yeah.
Yeah, so like this is a movie she has made based off already being fantastic in another movie when she was even younger. Like, to say that you're not as good as Drew Barrymore is not an insult, because this kid is fantastic. She's just not Drew Barrymore.
No, like, in terms of child actors, yeah, there's no real comparison.
But yeah, she's good and creepy, and you feel for her, and I really like how they added a couple of aspects of her being, like, personally bullied to kind of, like, give her more of a real life aspect that you can relate to, that kids can relate to. But this is definitely Zac Efron's movie. This is his character. He's the one who gets the most screen time, I believe, certainly compared to her.
Yeah, it probably skews a bit more in his favor, but I'd say he and Ryan are pretty neck and neck.
Yeah.
And also, just a quick note, speaking of the bullies, if the Stephen King psychopath bullies are your thing, this is a movie for you. Because there's that one kid who's constantly picking on Charlie that's just... That kid is going to be a serial killer. I'm sorry.
There's reoccurring bully characters in a good deal of Stephen King's books. And I believe eventually, like after books and books and books, and you've like grown up hating this guy, he finally kills himself. And you're just like, yay, it's over. I believe Kevin Bacon plays him in Stand By Me.
Nice.
Yeah. But yeah, okay, so and to streamline this is half an hour shorter than the 1984 version. They delete that entire lull, which means removing a ton of John Rainbird exposition. Like, he never at this point in this movie befriends Charlie. He's essentially a mercenary on a mission throughout the entire thing. It makes for a completely different way of playing it. I kind of like it because it turns him more into the unknowable henchman. Like he's kind of like a Bond villain.
Yeah, he really, really is.
Yeah. And especially when like there are moments in this where it's like, he just mows down whoever the hell's in front of him. And it has no idea. It doesn't matter who it is. It's just, you know, he is his own agent. They just happen to point him towards someone that he wants to, like, you can't tell if it's kill or, like, raise as a soldier or something. But it's like, he has decided that, yep, I want this. It's good that our goals align for this, but I will fucking kill all of you if you get in my way. And it's a far more interesting character, despite having far less screen time.
Oh, it's a far more interesting performance. The character toward the end, almost the further you go along with him, the less and less sense he starts to make.
Yeah, until you reach the end where it's like, what?
Yeah. So yeah. I was just going to say, it feels like all the material from that lull was in the movie, but was taken out.
Yeah, and like... It would have made sense if there was even just a couple of scenes where they like mind spoke to each other or something. Or if he was just like, we've been mind speaking for weeks now. We are on the same level. Or if he's the one who helped her, you know. He did lead her, but to the facility. But like, she didn't know that. There's no relationship there. And if they kind of recognized each other afterwards, there's no indication of that. Like, all you needed was like maybe a music cue. Like, when he uses his Shining, which is, you know, like it's Stephen King, when he uses a Shining, there should have been that sound that like he's shining at her, she shines back, and so at the end they shine together. That would have made sense. But yeah, really well performed by Michael Gray Eyes. He's a Canadian Plains Cree performer from Saskatchewan, and he does incredible kind of suspenseful, terrifying work with so little character left.
Yeah.
Like they just stripped everything out. They gave him mind powers. That's cool. But I think he has maybe 5 minutes screen time in this entire thing. It's feels so strange compared.
Yeah. Yeah. No, five, I would say 10 minutes tops.
Yeah.
Toward the end, suggested that he was the one who told Charlie where the facility was. And this is a problem in the movie in that I thought it was Andy who sent that image so that Charlie would know where he was.
Mm-hmm.
I did not get the sense that it would have been Rainbird at all.
And I'm only thinking it was him because when she got it, There's a shot that like shows him concentrating in his prison cell. And it's like, okay, I think he is trying to like use her to break out of this facility. Like,
That could be.
There's just more dialogue that needed to be had to be had. It's not necessarily you need that entire 6 month reprieve of action, but there are moments and suggestions in this that like he has a really interesting history as a subject with it's not actually the shop in this place. It's DSI, some company.
No, it's both.
It is okay.
Yeah, they do refer to it as the shop.
Okay, and oh yeah, yeah, this is the shop, right? Yes, it'll be just fine. He has a really cool backstory, and like, just insert him like mind talking to Charlie a little bit more. Have him clearly be more autonomous than reactive, of being like, oh yeah, no, I'm using this entire operation for my own gains. I'm going to get these motherfuckers, and my revenge is going to be you, because you're way more powerful than I am, kid.
Yeah, no, that would have worked a lot better.
You know, and it's a shame about that. You can enjoy the whole film by itself. Without that necessarily getting in the way. The problem with this film, I feel, is it feels old. It's not like, oh, this feels like a movie that was shot 10 years ago. It's more like narrative has moved beyond this. It even checks at some point. It goes, you're a superhero, Charlie. And it's like, yeah, that's why they don't make these movies anymore. Because she's just an earlier version of having a superhero or a superpower on screen. You had to explain it away. You couldn't have him wear tights or anything. And so we ended up with Firestarter. But we can have the X-Men. Why has this not been made into an X-Men film?
No, that's an excellent question. And frankly, I love that you specifically said that it feels old, because pretty much at that exact moment, what I was going to bring up was how the 2022 movie, for me, felt very much like something in the vein of like The Craft or Disturbing Behavior. Like a smidge of horror, a little bit of superpowers. And in a lot of ways, especially in that third act, just very formulaic.
Yeah, like you could see this being the Halloween special presentation of the Sci-Fi Channel in their last few years.
Yeah. Oh,
it's
yeah.
like, we've put oh, a yeah. ton of fucking money into this. This is our exclusive remake of Firestarter. And we even got two names. The old guy from That 70s Show and Zac Efron, who you probably didn't expect to be in this movie. And yeah, it's just, it feels like that level of production where it's like, you're giving it your all. You really are. And you're committing to giving the fans things that they want to see. But that doesn't necessarily make it watchable entirely. And it kind of feels rushed and empty in certain places when you could have just taken the time, slowed down, and filled it out. And it would have been fine. Don't worry. You're not going to go into a bloviated extra half an hour. You're not in danger of that. Take your time.
Yeah, and particularly toward the end when Charlie runs into the forest to get away from Rainbird. And there's like almost a training montage. And then she comes back out of the forest. She has her plan. She uses her dad's powers to steal a kid's bike. And it's great scenery. It's well put together and all that. It's 5 minutes of film that probably should have been 10.
Yeah, because it feels abrupt. And a lot of this. So the unspoken of elephant in the room for this kind of thing, and for any Stephen King going forward for the next who knows how many years, is God damn, this is a lot like Stranger Things, but of course Stranger Things is, is a lot like this. And I feel like any creative decision that this makes that feels odd is either to feel like or to distance themselves from Stranger Things. And having her 11 about outside a rock quarry would be too much.
Frankly, yeah, it really would. But that's also, I think, where they get stuck, because you almost needed a little bit more of that 11ing about.
Yeah.
To believe that she has this control over her powers.
Yeah, or you need to see her, like, find a way to let loose in a way that isn't, like, random. Like, she has to kind of, like, focus her anger. And you could have just a moment of John Rainbird, like, in her head, teaching her these things.
Yeah.
For some reason. Like he could walk up to the woods and like, mind stretch out and be like, Charlie, I'm not trying to hurt you. The people who did this to you did this to me as well. They sent me to hunt you. Yes, I have to bring you in, but we're going to bring this whole fucking thing down. We're just going to burn it to the ground. That's what I'm actually doing. Before that, I need you to do this. And you don't have to exposition dump all that at the same time. You can have it come up later and be like, how can she know all of this? And John Rainbird comes around the door and is just like, I taught her. But no.
No, and especially where you pretty much have that scene toward the end of the movie.
Right? It just to fill in the fucking blanks. Just fill in the blanks.
The opportunity was right there.
Yeah. So, yeah, her as with the book, her father gets captured, but we skip that whole segment and she just goes right to breaking into the shop and engulfing the captain and her father in fire so that, hey, the captain's dead. And the last words of her father, as with, of course, previously, is, burn them, Charlie, burn them all.
Yep.
Immortal words. Burn them all, Charlie. At which point she does. And we get that pretty decent sequence of her just taking motherfuckers out.
Oh, no, they do very much take advantage of the fact that, of course, this is like 40 years later. So this movie is going to have much better effects for them to play with Charlie. And also though with Gloria Rubin's Captain Hollister, which Gloria Rubin should not be playing villains.
Yeah, it just doesn't work.
No.
You kind of get a feeling that she's supposed to be going for an Amanda Waller, but she does not have the hardness, the cruel heart to be Amanda Waller. No. But she's not empathetic either. Like Martin Sheen's just doing his job, but she feels like, this is unnecessary. What are you doing here? You made a bad choice. You really do not have to be involved in this. You continue to be. Therefore, you are a worse person. I actually empathize more with Martin Sheen in the 80s. 80s Sheen. That's not supposed to happen.
No, I mean, like we said earlier, Martin Sheen is very much a company man, so you understand his motivations. Gloria Rubin feels like she's trying to be Cate Blanchett in Hannah, but doesn't know how to get there.
Yeah, like, and she comes off super sinister, but not in the, like, I'm not sinister, I'm just operating this government project. She comes off sinister, like, the evil, yes, and then, you know, it's like, but why? Why are you
it was like,
douchey, She even, like, arrests John Rainbird and, like she doesn't trust him with anything. Meanwhile, in the other film, the 84 film, John Rainbird's literally in their, like, executive office from the very first episode, just hanging around, being like, why the fuck is George C. Scott here? What does this have to do with anything?
No, and, yeah, like, Gloria Rubin is switching from benevolent to mustache twirling sinister, like almost from scene to scene.
Yeah.
And then you get to the final confrontation and she starts playing the, well, no, I'm going to stand behind your dad, and then if you burn me, you burn him too. And that entire sequence where there should be tension, I should be nervous, I'm sitting there going, Captain, you just saw Charlie selectively burn herself.
Yeah.
I don't think standing near Dad is really going to do anything, because she can still light only you on fire.
Yeah. Also, at this point, I don't necessarily, like, you haven't been the kind of villain where it's like, yeah, suffer. It's more like, Charlie, just kill her so that we can move the fuck on. Yeah. I'm tired of this. I'm tired. Burn her. And she does. And Zac Efron takes it like a champ. Then she helps everyone escape the facility. I would have loved to see a few more people, like, come out and, like, they have different powers or something.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, even just being like, anyway, she just essentially unleashed her own mutant team and they are going to fuck shit up. But instead, she meets up with John Rainbird and she wanders out to the lake by the facility. Everything's catching on fire around her. John Rainbird wanders up. They sit down. He picks her up and walks off. The end.
Yeah, I don't think either version of Firestarter really gets the ending right.
No, like, and it's a book ending, you know? It's like there's nothing you can do about it. The 1984 movie, I think, gets it closest. They do the best that they can. But God, this ending only makes sense, as you said, if there were other scenes that were necessary and could not have been cut, but clearly are not here because we haven't seen them.
Yeah. Whereas the 84 one, after everything happens, it ends with Charlie going back to, the Mander's farm.
Yeah.
And that kind of doesn't work, because the last time that we saw this couple, it's basically, it's Kai Winn yelling, go away, we don't want you here.
Yeah, yeah. And then they just, like, because they're kindly, they are the Kents, they're a kindly farm couple. They take her in and then drive her to New York City to meet with the New York Times. In the book, she goes and stays there for a little bit, but the shop reforms and, like, starts hunting her again, and she leaves and goes to Rolling Stone, who I presume...
What?
I must... Yeah, so, okay, at the time...
Oh, my God.
No, this makes sense. You just have to be a real fucking nerd to understand it. At the time... Rolling Stone did a lot of really great exposure journalism, especially like during the Nixon years, the later Jimmy Carter years, and into Reagan. And at this exact moment, they had on staff as a writer, certainly an available writer, Hunter S. Thompson. And I just want the sequel where it's Hunter Thompson and a pyrokinetic little girl investigating the government or, like, going off on wacky adventures. I want that.
Yes. Yeah. Yes. Yes. Yeah.
We're going to fucking expose the government. Go bring those goddamn leeches out. Light them on fire. Burn them, Charlie. Burn them all.
Oh, Jesus God, Christ. That would be amazing.
Good time. Anyway, but yeah, I guess overall the, while 2022's Firestarter came in lukewarm and tepid, not bad, just, all right. I found 1984 starring Drew Barrymore to be the hotness.
You are not wrong. I mean, the 2022 one, again, it's not bad, but like I said, it slots in more with The Craft or Disturbing Behavior or so forth. It's not bad. It's kind of memorable. Would you go back to it anytime soon? Probably not.
Yeah, no, I'm happy I saw it. I enjoy Zac Efron in everything, not just because of his looks. My God, his looks.
Yeah.
But he's a good actor. Like, I initially discovered Zac Efron for myself way back in Hairspray. And it's like, oh, shit, this guy can actually, like, act. And he's funny. And I kind of actually, like, naturally like him. And it has nothing to do with his looks, but my God, his looks. Anyway.
Yeah, no, Zac Efron is that actor who kind of skirts the line of going the Taylor Kitsch route.
Yeah.
But he never actually steps over.
Thank God.
And he pulls himself. Yeah, and he is able to pull himself back from that line from time to time.
Yeah, I'd really like to see him do more horror because I think this will serve him well. Instead of like, I know it feels natural for him to necessarily go like the Channing Tatum route where it's like, you know, it's tongue in cheek hotness, you know, but I think he's got more in the tank than that.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh yeah, definitely.
Yeah. I would love to see him. And this is as a fan of the original, I would love to see him do something like Wicker Man. Cause he's someone I can believe in that kind of like, he's the kind of actor I could get behind being like, oh yeah, no, your presumptions are entirely fucking flawed. I see good things for him in horror. I hope he sticks with it. And this Drew Barrymore kid might become something good. I don't know.
Yeah. She might do a few movies, maybe host a talk show.
Be married to Tom Green for, I don't know, 30 minutes, an hour? That didn't last long.
And then pray to God we all forget about it. With Zac Efron and more horror, as you were describing the possibility of him in a remake of The Wicker Man, I'm sitting here going, I could see that as the equivalent for him of Leonardo DiCaprio in Shutter Island.
Yes, yes, absolutely. Push that pretty boy into hard psychological horror and see how he copes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, that would totally work.
That would be cool. Yeah, overall, like, it's not bad. The new one's not bad. It's just,
no.
Oh, I wish you came out, like, even 10 years ago. You probably would have done better. The classic is often forgotten, but really, if you love good schlock, if you love Chris Claremont era X-Men, if you just love George C. Scott doing whatever the hell it is George C. Scott does, by all means, watch that film.
Now, just one last quick thing with Firestarter. I just want to quickly float a recasting idea.
Ooh, recasting.
Take Kurtwood Smith out.
Mm-hmm.
Because he doesn't really do anything. He doesn't need to be there.
He really doesn't need to be there. I mean, it's a great paycheck for Kurtwood Smith.
Yeah. Like,
dude,
oh, yeah.
What do you, he's playing with pixie sticks. He's just playing with pixie sticks. I don't know.
And put Toby Jones in that role.
Ooh, yeah.
Make it a legacy role.
That'd be really good. That would have been smart.
Because that character in the original was played by his father.
No, that would be really smart. That would work and make it this ongoing thing. I'm kind of surprised that considering serialized media these days, there wasn't kind of of reference, like someone didn't slam down a file and it opens up and there's Drew Barrymore as a kid there, you know, or like modern shot of Drew Barrymore. And it's like, she's not the first Charlie. We've been running these Charlie operations all around for the last decade. We just clone her, set up the same scenario and see if it plays out differently. There's actually a whole like slew of Charlies and oh God, if they ever find out about each other.
Firestarter. Project McGee. And it's like half Firestarter, half Orphan Black.
Yeah.
Like, that would totally work.
But of course, being half orphan black will never get funding for it.
Well, true.
Thank you so much for listening. If you enjoyed this episode of Real Geeks, please like, share, subscribe, and leave a comment. And if you'd like to get in touch with us directly to possibly disagree with us physically by throttling our collective reviews, contact us at email, line,
realgeekshfx@gmail.com.
That one. What he said.
And if Twitter is easier for you, that's also our Twitter handle.
You'd think I'd remember it then. No.
And yet, week after week.
And yet, week after week. It's almost as if it's actually a setup for a dialogue. Weird. Anyway.
God bless the running gag.
Ah, too fun. Speaking of Ryan Gang, we will see you soon later this week with the B-roll. It's going to be peachy keen. Until then.
See ya.
See ya.